Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed. No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit podcast. We rarely begin with breaking news, but we have breaking news.
And that news is that SJP has debuted a spicy jalapeno-infused Sauvignon Blanc.
This is from her wine imprint in Vivo. Is this woman allergic to tequila? That was my first thought. Because when I think of jalapeno-infused alcohol, I think tequila, I think vodka. I don't think wine, let alone a Sauvignon Blanc.
She will make a jalapeno-infused wine before a Cosmopolitan in a can.
Well, according to Wine Spectator, it's aromatic and fruit-forward. With all the upfront melon, lime, and tropical chords one expects from a tasty Sauvignon Blanc, along with textbook refreshment. It's true that the natural green notes in the wine, fresh grass, gooseberry, make jalapeno a complimentary addition. The heat from the pepper starts out very mild and builds subtly with time, but it never overwhelms.
I'll be the judge of that.
There is a video from Wine Spectator with Sarah Jessica Parker, and I assume someone who works at Wine Spectator.
She looks like she has a gun to her head off camera.
Who, Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yes. She's like, why the fuck do I have to garnish my jalapeno-infused wine?
Well, yeah, the concept that Wine Spectator is kind of going for is cocktailifying this drink, which makes sense. And at the end of the video, the woman's like, after putting a jalapeno and a grapefruit garnish, she's like, wow, this makes a really great spritz. And then Sarah Jessica Parker just sips her drink and she's like, I like it like this, meaning like, I like it the way it's intended. A jalapeno infused Sauvignon Blanc straight into the glass.
She's also like, I can't really drink this right now. It's too early. Do they have to film this at 6 a.m.?
Well, to me, her launching a jalapeno-infused spicy wine, I mean, let's give her her due, right? I think the first person who thought, what if we made wine spicy?
Apparently, it's based on like a viral TikTok thing.
And Tad hasn't told us about this?
Tad is the one who alerted me to this Sarah Jessica Parker wine. So I think that if she was aware of this, she would have told me.
Naturally. But I think this can only mean one thing, which is next week, Sarah Jessica Parker will be on Hot Ones to shill her spicy wine.
I wish. The wine doesn't come out until June. But apparently the jalapeno-infused Sauvignon Blanc is available at Total Wine. We do have one of those in West Hollywood now, praise be. So we will be able to buy this.
I mean, I think that Wine Spectator person was correct. It seems like it would be a great refreshing spritz for the summer.
It does, but also I wonder if my digestive system is strong enough to handle this wine. Like, things could go south quickly.
Yeah, I am concerned with the description that while the jalapeno flavor starts out mild, it does build.
Anyway, guys, we'll buy this when it comes out. We'll report back. Or we could just get wasted while we record the show.
Sure, what could go wrong? So for today's episode, it's kind of split in two. We have two categories of topics to discuss. One we're calling gay interests, and the other is fashion.
So our first gay interest news item is Charlie XCX's new video for her song SS26, directed by Torso, who we love. And in this video, Charlie is living out her very own Carrie Bradshaw modeling fantasy, I would say.
Which is to say that she becomes fashion roadkill.
Yes.
But this is a music video, and I love this type of music video where the artist is multiple people in the music video. So she is Carrie Bradshaw falling. She is also Heidi Klum walking over herself. She's in the crowd. She's a pop star. I also feel like they do recreate that Amber Valletta, Shalom Harlow bumping into each other on the Todd Oldham runway moment.
Totally. They used all the right references. And I like the way they visualize the lyric about the runway that goes straight to hell when the models just like fall off the edge of the runway into the abyss.
I mean, I guess that is how she falls, is out of her heel, which is a trope in many fashion shows. I think my favorite ever model falling on the runway is not Naomi Campbell in the gigantic Vivienne Westwood shoes, but that one Tom Ford Gucci collection where he decided to have these fur rugs and none of the models could walk on them. And so multiple models fell.
I don't remember that.
Wow. A deep cut even for you, Chelsea. I'm proud. But yes, it's worth going back on fashion television on YouTube to watch it. So that's a deep cut moment that I wish had been in the music video, but it is chock full of fashion references and deep cut fashion industry people in the music video.
Yeah, we got a bunch of cameos. The most famous people being Corinne Reutfeld, who actually had a line of dialogue, Michelle Gobert, Anthony Vaccarello, Deborah Shaw, which was cool. And then we got like cool designers like the people from Vaquera and August Baron. Also, one of our favorite Every Outfit guests, Patrick Sandberg, made an appearance. We love that.
Love to see him.
But I also liked that it wasn't really about clout bombing. Like, it was a realistic looking front row, but that wasn't really the aim of the video. It's not like it was another 360 in that regard.
It was very, if you know, you know.
Yeah, very blink or you'll miss it.
It seems like the concept for this album between, what was it, Rock Music is the first single?
Yep.
And certainly SS26. It feels like the hangover from the Brat album.
Totally.
After you've partied too hard all summer long,
you write a sad little song like SS26 in your fancy hotel room. Okay. In other gay news, Isabelle Huppert presented Barbra Streisand with an honorary Palme d'Or at the closing ceremony.
Yes, we recently did a VIP episode about the Cannes Film Festival where we discussed that Barbra Streisand is one of three people who got an honorary Palme d'Or this year, John Travolta famously being the other one.
Bless.
Barbra Streisand could not be there in person because she had a knee injury?
I forget if it was a knee injury or a hip injury, but some injury that prevents her from traveling.
I think this is so surprising to us, delightfully so, because I would not think that Isabelle Huppert was a huge Barbra Streisand fan.
Yet she spent 5 minutes talking about how amazing Yentl is. And honestly, respect. Hard agree.
And how she was once at Barbra Streisand's house in Malibu for a private concert.
She said it was a fundraiser for the Democratic Party in some regard, but we read something else online that said that it was what exactly?
Yeah, a private concert for 500 couples that I'm sure was also a fundraiser event for the Democratic Party.
But it was like the first time that she had performed live in like over a decade or something like that, because Barbra Streisand has crippling stage fright.
Do you think the concert was held out on the lawn or downstairs at her little doll mall?
I don't know. I wonder if it was that same house. But I don't think she had built the fake mall in her basement until like the early 2000s or maybe the late 90s.
You think her marriage to James Brolin empowered her to build this?
It's possible.
You're burying the lead, which is that Isabelle Huppert dressed on theme to look like Barbra Streisand.
Yeah, she wore a sequin Loewe gown that was a tribute to the Scazi ensemble that she won the Oscar in for Funny Girl. Although she opted against the Peter Pan collar element of it, as well as the sheer bell-bottom element of it.
I think that was wise.
But like, it was such an obvious reference. It takes 1 second to see what she's doing. And I thought it was so fun and cool. And we rarely get to see her do any sort of theme dressing. We saw it at the Camp Met Gala when she came dressed like Divine. But it's not something that she's doing a lot.
Yeah, I can't see her pulling a Margot Robbie themed press tour for like a Paul Verhoeven film. Although I would be delighted to see that.
She did kind of do that actually at Cannes, I think, when The Piano Teacher premiered, where she had all of those words written on her body in French, and it was like, Bach is proof that God exists or something like that.
Well, she does it in a very Isabelle Huppert way.
She also talked about Barbara Streisand's hands and how she has the best hands in the history of cinema, and I wholeheartedly agree.
I need to go back and watch Yentl, which I've never seen before.
Oh, wow. I would love to watch Yentl with you.
Let's do it.
Barbara Streisand has these very glamorous long fingers and then just these psychotic, evil-looking, like, talon nails, which she had for the 70s, the 80s. I don't know when she stopped doing that.
I don't know when she stopped, but I learned through this speech and the articles around it that Barbara Streisand originally grew her nails long in protest because her mother wanted her to be a secretary and a typist.
And she's like, no, bitch, have you heard my voice?
I'm meant for Hollywood.
I think the best example of Barbara Streisand's nails is actually on the album cover of The Way We Were, where she looks very different than she looks in that film. She looks almost more like a Joan Collins in Dynasty, even Grace Jones kind of look.
She's wearing a head covering, but the way that it is photographed makes her look like she's got long black hair.
It's so good. Her nails are also featured prominently on the album cover of her album Lazy Afternoon, which I'm obsessed with because she's dressed up like a hippie. Like, you would think she was in Fleetwood Mac or something, which is obviously like so not true to who Barbara Streisand actually is. And you can tell instantly because she has these long pink pointy nails, like no hippie bitch would ever.
You know, this is making me think. I've always done an almond shape with my Gel X extensions, but there's something very compelling about her nails, which are natural, of doing like a long square nail.
Well, they're kind of almond shaped, but then the tip is square, but it's not like a coffin nail either. It is very alluring. And I do think that you should explore this.
I can't wait for the nail technicians at Butter Nails to be utterly confused when I show these reference photos.
Yeah, just bring in a Barbra Streisand LP. That would be perfect. But I do love that they are talking about Yentl. Barbara also talked about Yentl in her acceptance speech, which she spent 15 years trying to make Yentl. By the time she made it, she was way too old to play the lead character, which you will find very amusing when you finally watch this movie.
Well, she's a little boy, right?
No, she's a girl pretending to be a boy so she can get an education, okay?
So she can become a rabbi.
Yes.
I know enough about this movie.
Okay, but also people forget that Barbra Streisand was, I believe, the first woman to win a Golden Globe for directing, and that was for Yentl. So she really was a groundbreaking female director, and no one really talks about it, and she doesn't get credit. And I'm sure it was really hard for her, obviously, to get that movie made and to get her other projects off the ground, despite being as famous and successful as she was.
And famously, yes, she won Best Director at the Golden Globes, and she was the first woman to do so, but then she was snubbed for even a nomination at the Oscars that same year.
Just like Madonna and Evita.
Yes, Chelsea, exactly like that.
Still thinking about it. It is exactly like that.
I don't think Patti LuPone feels the same way.
Okay. In other news, a Jawbreaker musical is in development.
Well, I did a little research into this. It's essentially being workshopped.
It's being workshopped at a very small theater in West Hollywood. So don't expect this to be like the equivalent of Death Becomes Her on Broadway or something.
Oh, Chelsea, you think it's West Hollywood? It's East Hollywood. It's that theater district near the Hollywood Cemetery. Now, by the way, no shade. We will be there in September to watch this.
Oh, absolutely. And I love that Darren Stein, the genius who wrote and directed the original film, did write the book for this. So that's cool. Rebecca Gayhart will be returning in the Carol Kane role. But yes, I don't think we should expect that this will be a lavish production.
The music is being done by a man named Jeff Thompson, who, when I looked him up, he has previously worked at the Hollywood Hudson Theater doing a version of Pump Up the Volume yes, the Christian Slater film about a pirate radio station, which I guess they were trying to make into a musical. And I'm so deeply sad I was unaware of this and therefore never got to see it.
Well, we can make up for that with Jawbreaker.
Absolutely.
Okay. I feel like a lot of people have been sleeping on Diane Sawyer's latest special, which is about Richard Simmons.
I think a lot of people are sleeping on it, including myself, until you brought it to my attention because it's so bizarre.
People are sleeping on it because they haven't heard about it, which I don't understand because it's like on my front page of Hulu every single day, as it should be.
Well, Hulu understands you. I think maybe people haven't watched it yet because it does feel like there has been so much media, podcasts, docuseries, news in the last 5 to 10 years about like, where the fuck did Richard Simmons go? And I guess Diane Sawyer gets the closest to answering why he became a recluse in the last 10 years of his life.
Yeah, because what's noteworthy about this special is that she interviewed his housekeeper, which is the only person that was living with him for the last 10 years of his life when he disappeared from public life. And she just basically straight up said, like, he didn't like the way he looked. He didn't want to be photographed.
Which is so funny because he just looked like a slightly older version of Richard Simmons.
Totally. It's extremely sad.
Well, there's also this thing about him where he was forgotten. I don't know if we talked about this with the Pee Wee Herman documentary, but that second part made me sob at the idea that Paul Rubens thought that people forgot about him or he wouldn't be remembered. And it seems like Richard Simmons had the same feeling until a parody video of Pauly Shore pretending, or I guess trying to grassroots a biopic where he plays Richard Simmons came out, which made Richard Simmons make a public statement of like, that's not happening, I exist. And then the outpouring of love he saw was like, oh, people love me? I didn't know that.
It's so sad. And I kind of get it because he unfairly kind of got looped in with the broader cultural conversation around toxic diet culture. And he fell out of fashion like all of those people.
I mean, as the Diane Sawyer documentary displays, of all of the diet culture and diet fads and videos, his had the gentlest of hands. I actually do wonder if stuff like The Biggest Loser kind of impacted him and his business, where it became a competition and not a lifestyle.
Right. I think he was always just lumped in with those people. But he actually did a lot of extremely positive, subversive things, many of which are addressed in the Diane Sawyer special, like casting overweight people to be in his exercise videos instead of like insanely fit people, which is what Jane Fonda and everyone else was doing at the time. He was making exercise tapes for elderly people and disabled people. He was making business decisions that were inclusive, not just signaling that he was inclusive.
Can we cut it back? Because I think the most confusing thing about this documentary, at least for me, until I watched it, was why is Diane Sawyer doing this? And she answers that question, which is she was the only person that Richard Simmons granted an interview to, and they were working on when to film this interview, and then he passed away. And so Richard Simmons' family gave Diane Sawyer access to his house, which appears to be like a mausoleum, untouched the last 2 years since his death.
Although we have seen photos of the house before. I think they did come out after his death for some reason, because that painting of him with the Dalmatians, that's iconic. And also the terrifying Barbara Streisand doll, unforgettable.
I wrote in my notes as I was watching it, of course he has multiple hyper-realistic babies.
Yeah. He was an eccentric guy.
Did he ever officially come out? Because that is part of the documentary. Like, there is this focal point in the late 90s where they use Ellen DeGeneres coming out and then Rosie O'Donnell coming out, who, no idea that Rosie O'Donnell and Richard Simmons were friends, but that does make sense.
Yeah, Rosie talks about trying to engage with him about his gayness off camera and said that she was basically rebuffed. Like, not in a rude way, but he would never open up to her. in that way, which, fair enough, after the whole Clay Aiken incident.
Was that Rosie on The View that did that?
Yeah, that was Rosie.
Right. Well, Rosie explains in the documentary that she didn't give him the Clay Aiken treatment. It was more just like, you know, my wife and I have a child.
Do you have a partner? Like that kind of vibe.
There is something very interesting about Richard Simmons where his on-camera persona did match his off-camera persona. The way that he presented his personal life to a Howard Stern or a Rosie O'Donnell or whomever he was being interviewed by seems to be how he addressed it to friends in his real life as well.
Totally. And I get the sense that he was out, or at least willing to talk about that with some of his inner circle, but no one is going to out him after his death, which is cool.
Do you think his longtime housekeeper still lives in the house?
Maybe. I think he set her up. He clearly loved her. Like, that woman and his Dalmatians were his world at the end of his life. And I also wouldn't be surprised if it was kind of like Tim Gunn vibes where he's gay and asexual or something. I feel like he exists at the intersection of several identities, but we just will never know what those are.
Well, yeah, the housekeeper certainly didn't tell us.
She did tell us that when they did go on walks during the 10 years that he was hiding from the public, he would disguise himself as a woman or a clown.
Oh my God, I wanted to talk about this. Could you imagine running into a disguise Richard Simmons as a clown?
I bet he was fully doing tricks for people because he just loved making people happy in this very genuine way. But also, I wonder what his woman look was like. And it was also brought up in this documentary that he would go to private dinners dressed as a woman.
Honestly, you know when people at parties ask, like, who would you love to have, living or dead, at a dinner party? It's like Richard Simmons, alive or dead, but disguised as a woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
I knew that he passed away a few years ago. I was unaware that his death was classified as accidental because he had an injury on his birthday. It seems like the reason that he receded from public life was a mixture of a few things. His body was ailing. Diane Sawyer shows this juxtaposition of videos of him maybe in his 40s and the way he moved compared to a video from him in his 60s where he moved a bit stiffer.
And he had some sort of chronic knee injury, so he really couldn't continue to do the aerobics that he had been doing for so many years.
That mixed with the death of his last Dalmatian, as they phrase it, I think that just took him under.
Ugh, I feel so bad for him. He's just such a sweet, beautiful person, and he spent so much of his career being the butt of the joke in this fucked up way. Not for everyone, obviously. A lot of people loved Richard Simmons, and he really did change a lot of people's lives, but I really think he deserves a reappraisal. And watching this made me really long for a prestige documentary about his life and his impact, like the full Matt Wolf treatment.
Ooh.
Because I believe we talked about this when he passed away, but he used to have a jewelry line that was like successful enough that like Rudy Gernreich used his designs in his fashion shows. He started one of the first plus size activewear lines in the world.
Right, right, right. We did discuss this.
Like there is a huge fashion aspect to his story that I've always thought was really, really interesting.
Chell, is it time for every outfit to produce their first documentary? It's sounding like it.
Someone needs to. And also the fact that one of his workout tapes was the top selling VHS tape in the world at that time is insane. Like that's an extraordinary thing to accomplish.
I believe in this documentary, Diane Sawyer said that it generated $200 million in sales. You know what this documentary also showed me is there's a lot of Deborah Vance taken from Richard Simmons because, yes, she's inspired by Joan Rivers, but I don't think Joan Rivers had the same fan club and relationship that Deborah Vance has with her fans. And while watching this, there's a lot of B-roll footage of him calling people that did his workout methodology and just making sure that they were okay. And that felt very Deborah Vance.
Totally. Like, he was almost like an unofficial, like, Overeaters Anonymous sponsor to, like, hundreds of people at all times that were in his program. And I remember us talking about this when he passed away, but he built this exercise video empire because he ran this very successful gym in Los Angeles that looked so incredible that had a salad bar attached to it. Like, it had a restaurant attached to it. And as I remember, it was like the first salad bar that wasn't attached to a steakhouse. Like, he's a genius.
We would have no Erewhon without him.
No Erewhon, no plus size activewear. Incredible.
Before we move on, we should talk about what I think is my favorite moment in this documentary, which is Diane Sawyer walking into Richard Simmons' closet and going through all of the bedazzled shorts and shirts that he had.
Yep. There were some good ones. Very Jeremy Scott at times. Very Ashish coated, like, sequin tunics.
However, the cherub paintings with positive mantras was a bit disturbing in the bathroom.
But he really was one of those people that seemed genuinely positive, even though there is, like, a deep sadness lurking beneath, you know, like a Karen Carpenter type thing.
Yeah, he chose positivity and hope until his last 10 years when he was like, enough. There is something enviable about a recluse lifestyle the last few years. As long as you're not being taken advantage by a predatory lawyer or a housekeeper.
It seems like he had a lot of fun with the housekeeper. They sang songs from Hamilton. He was working on music, apparently, for a Broadway show about his life, which I'd really die to see that.
Which allowed for, given his workouts, people to dance during the musical.
Oh, yeah. He was like, we need to remove the first, like, five rows of chairs so people can just do aerobics in the theater.
You know how I feel about musicals? Would die to see this.
You know what else seemed really lit? His funeral procession in New Orleans.
Which is where he was from, which I had no idea before this documentary.
R.I.P. Richard. We love you.
Before we move on, speaking of Rosie O'Donnell, you were like, there's something I'm forgetting. And I sent you and I was like, oh, is it the fact that Rosie O'Donnell hard launched her facelift?
And I didn't know about this until you sent me her Instagram post.
Which also made me aware of the fact that Rosie O'Donnell has a Substack, because of course Rosie O'Donnell has a Substack.
Rosie O'Donnell has been an early adopter of a lot of different platforms. Like, she was an early blogger also, if you'll remember, on rosieodonnell.com back in the day.
And a prolific tweeter.
Yeah. And now she has a new face, but it's not like a crazy Kris Jenner transformation. Although, to be fair, like, with Rosie O'Donnell, it's like she's never once, like, had makeup on and taken a selfie. Like, there could be a more dramatic before and after if she was just, like, a little more done up in the after.
Well, I think we talked about this previously, but Ricky Lake had an incredible facelift that she was very open about, and she debuted, I think, earlier this year on Andy Cohen's Watch What Happens Live.
Yeah, that was great. Good for Ricky.
All right, on to fashion.
We need to talk about the Gucci Cruise Show,
which we watched live on my phone at dinner while we were in Palm Springs a couple of weekends ago, which our waiter fully thought we were insane. Usually people are watching, I don't know, sports games.
Well, it was the same day as that, what is it, UFC fight? I don't know, whatever that was. There's with Ronda Rousey or whatever her name is. Rousey?
Ronda Rousey.
Rousey. I don't know about these things.
Versus Gia Carano, which you're right. Tat was like, we got to go back to watch it. And then by the time we got back from Toucans, the drag club, the fight was over because it only lasted 7 seconds. And Tat didn't even watch the 7 seconds. She's like, I don't care anymore.
I watched it. It was deeply unsatisfying to watch. I can't imagine being in the room watching it live.
But you know what was deeply satisfying to watch? This Gucci cruise show, which took place in Times Square. That alone, I mean, the stunt, the spectacle of shutting down Times Square for a fashion show and also simultaneously taking over all of the screens
with fake ads. Some were real, but most were fake.
which did make us sad, especially the Gucci gym ad where we were like, oh, okay, I would buy some Gucci branded weights. And then we were like, oh, this is fake.
The Gucci longevity supplements, would love.
Kathy Horn's article about this in New York Magazine revealed the answer to the question I had, which is how much could this have cost? And I guess Francesca Bellatini told her, who is the chief executive of Gucci, that the bill for everything was around $10 million.
See, I would think it would be more than that. $10 million doesn't sound like that much. Like, it's pretty typical to spend $10 million on a fashion show.
Especially if you are shutting down several streets on a Saturday night? Yeah, it was Saturday night along many main thoroughfares in Times Square. Also, the screens, they pre-sold those ads. I don't know how you negotiate that. Anyway, another detail of the logistics of this fashion show I found very funny was that the technical command center was in a Dos Caminos and that the models were getting ready in an unnamed suit.
In the M&M store?
Oh, I wish. In an unnamed sushi restaurant.
Ooh, Times Square sushi. Wow.
I think it is very clear with this collection that the Demna Balenciaga customer is coming over to Gucci.
Yeah, I think it was reassuring for that customer because the last two collections, especially, the silhouette was very, very skinny. Every single look. This had more of a variety in terms of the silhouette.
It did, but it reaffirmed that Demna's Gucci very much has a body conscious focus, which is a different silhouette than he had at Balenciaga.
But still, there were looks in this show that could have been Balenciaga.
Yeah, I do think that Balenciaga Demna consumer who was maybe consumed with a hypebeast aesthetic, for lack of a better phrase, for it, is now just like, you know what? Let me dress like Eurotrash. That seems fun.
Totally. The fact that he is pushing this international male catalog beefcake Eurotrash look in this show most successfully with Tom Brady.
Oh my God.
In this insane leather outfit.
Which made him look like the Terminator.
So funny. Like a beefcake in a tight outfit is something we never see on the runway or very, very rarely. Like it is genuinely subversive to see a man look like that.
Well, the casting was also so good. You had Paris Hilton in a brown wig.
Cindy Crawford, Tom Brady. These are all much more mass casting choices than we would have seen him do in the past, certainly.
And I always find it delightful when Amelia Gray and Gabriette are both in the same fashion show.
Yeah. I feel like Sophia Lamar was the best casting for this show or for a show in New York because she has consistently been one of the coolest and most glamorous New Yorkers. She's part of the fabric of the city. And I would say my one casting criticism of this show is that a lot of people that were in it, I just don't associate with New York. Like Tish Weinstock, Sabine Getty, fabulous heiresses, but like not New Yorkers, British people. Athena Calderon, though, that was major.
That was incredible. She's coming off of an amazing, I would say, internet run. She just debuted her new apartment that went viral in Architectural Digest. We, of course, know her as the naked lady in the sauna that Charlotte is jealous of from that season 2 episode of Sex and the City.
She'd kill to have Charlotte's tits. Yeah, I have been anxiously awaiting the Athena Calderon Tribeca apartment reveal, which she has been teasing for a really long time.
Sort of like us with Every Outfit Studios.
Yes, because she became famous for the way she decorated her Brooklyn brownstone, which was so influential that like everything was copied basically. So she had to redecorate and move. Like she had no choice.
She was like, try to copy this.
Like when your apartment is now like at Target and CB2, like you have to move on.
Imagine having that kind of impact.
It's crazy. Well, it's happening again because the Tribeca apartment, she decorated in a very classical Art Deco style. And already I'm seeing the impact because all of the furniture dealers that I follow in Los Angeles that were previously selling mostly 60s, 70s, 80s stuff, they're now all selling Art Deco and people are buying it. It's selling fast. So I really think she does have a huge impact. And she also launched a line of furniture. I don't know if it's in collaboration with the Future Perfect or if it's just sold there, but she is really killing it.
Well, she seems to have a line at Crate and Barrel as well.
That's like her diffusion line.
Well, I also think it's like, if you're going to rip me off, I might as well get a commission for this.
Totally. But she's such genius casting for the Gucci show because she's an iconic New Yorker, but she's also the original Tom Ford Gucci customer. Like if you've seen photos of her from when she was younger, she was a model. She was wearing Gucci and Dolce and Gabbana and those kinds of brands. So it's cool to see her sort of fit into the Gucci world now.
So let's get into this collection because Demna, and we saw with the Vuitton show that we'll talk about in a second, European designers seem to have a fascination with New York right now. Because also Pierre Paolo's new Balenciaga commercial that has Sarah Pigeon in it that was directed by Celine Song takes place in New York. This seems to be top of mind with designers right now. And Demna's Gucci core for this cruise collection, the advertisements prior to this cruise show was remaking the Robert Longo
Men in Cities,
which wasn't really in the show itself, but definitely set the tone of like, this is Demna's idea of what working in New York in the 80s must feel like.
Totally. But when you look at the actual clothes, it feels way more LA than New York.
Because Demna lives in LA.
Because he lives here now. He's living in LA. He's thinking about Eurotrash. Like, to me, this doesn't remind me of the way that people dress in New York.
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, Demna's Gucci from that first fashion film that he did that debuted Archetypes, it's very much a sort of parallel universe idea of what the Gucci customer is. That I think what makes it different from past designers is what he's infusing in it is the way that a certain customer set, you might define them as Eurotrash, has bought and dressed in Gucci in the last 20 years. That was never upfront.
Yeah. There's something about this Gucci that feels much less gatekept than Balenciaga did. It feels very deliberately mass. It feels like he's embracing the tackiness of the customer and putting it front and center.
Absolutely. I think the buy now model is very, very smart, especially when it comes to accessories and shoes, which is all the consumer wants in the moment. Like they can wait for the clothes.
Totally. But I feel like the stuff that they actually did sell on the website, like, isn't the best stuff from the show. Like they debuted a lot of like very new looking handbags in the show. None of those are available to buy now. And then it's all like little things like a little donut necklace. Like I don't need that.
You don't want a little apple necklace with the Gucci emblem surrounding it?
Don't need that. But there was cool stuff. I liked the leather Gucci shopping bag. I liked the wallets and stuff like that.
Going back to the Tom Ford era, Gucci heel with the horse bit is very smart. I will buy one at some point.
I tried to convince you to recently, but you said no.
Okay. I would like to address that. It's because we're trying to find, or I'm trying to find, the correct heel height that I will actually wear. Because they seem to only make it in 2 inch or like 4.5 inch. And I'm just looking for a solid 3 inch heel.
Well, you're shit out of luck. I was trying to get Lauren to buy these specific shoes. And then I saw a photo of Isabelle Huppert wearing them at Cannes. In one of her casual looks, I sent it to Lauren. It's like, bitch, if this woman can wear a 6-inch heel, so can you.
Well, I've always wanted to be model height, so here's my chance.
I also want to touch upon a really, really exceptional look worn by an attendee, which was Laura Harrier, who wore a white spandex looking Gucci dress from the previous collection that was a very distinct homage to Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct.
Just incredible.
Perfectly executed. And she was leaning into the lore. She was like posting videos on Instagram of her crossing and uncrossing her legs.
Dare I say it looks better on her than the model that it appeared on?
Well, she is model level pretty. And I've brought this up before, but I really think a Mahogany remake starring Laura Harrier would be incredible. Just saying. Shall we move on to the Louis Vuitton cruise show? A fashion show for a woman who doesn't exist.
Well,
no woman aspires to dress like this. You know how there are different tribes of women? There's the Gucci woman. Then there's like the Andamulamister Rick Owens bitch. Like, there is no woman who wants to dress like this. Like, the full look.
Yeah. Nicola Ghesquiere's work at Vuitton continues to be confounding to me because his tenure at Balenciaga was so exquisite, and we discussed his work on last week's podcast episode. And to me, I think like the fall winter 2002 into the spring summer 2003 Balenciaga collections are some of the strongest back-to-back collections ever.
Absolutely. And wearable to boot.
And to see him turn out these kinds of collections season after season, I agree with you. I am not sure who this Vuitton is for. Like, are there people who are like, I would love a Harlequin look, but what if it was more athleisure forward?
The craziest thing about this shit is that it's like not even for celebrities, because I find that oftentimes when we see celebrities in Louis Vuitton, they're in custom looks that look nothing like the runway stuff. And like the first model in this show is dressed like a cast member of the Sister Act 2. Yet she is carrying a battered leather suitcase like she's Woody Guthrie hitchhiking through the Dust Bowl. Like, it's crazy. What story is being told here?
I'll tell you what story is being told here. If Demna was focused on Richard Longo, Nicola Ghesquiere is focused on Keith Haring. And so a lot of the pieces of clothing and a lot of certainly the bags, including that battered piece of luggage you're referring to, has Keith Haring art on it. To which I say the integration of Keith Haring's work in this collection is lazy at best and honestly disrespectful to the dead at worst.
Yeah, we were talking about this on a group chat with Lauren Kramer, but truly Keith Haring's work has never looked so lame in this context, which is insane because it has been licensed to so much mass market shit, right? Uniqlo, the constant presence at the MoMA design store. I'm pretty sure there was a very questionable Me Undies collab somewhere in there. But this is truly the worst artist collaboration that Louis Vuitton has done since those fucked up Jeff Koons bags.
Oh, wow. I erased those from my memory. I mean, clearly they are trying to have another Stephen Sprouse Murakami moment. And I know there is an audience that is going to buy these speedy bags with the Keith Haring paintings on them, but
the worst gay people.
The thing that I'm like, no one is going to buy, and I suppose I should dig into the Vuitton retail reports every quarter, is, are the clothes selling?
I think they do in Asia.
Yes. I would say the weakest part of any Vuitton collection is the clothing, but particularly the interpretation of these Keith Haring pieces, that bulbous boxy shirt that has the Keith Haring New York with the apple and the people. Like, who's wearing that?
I know. That one was really bad. I feel like we needed a stronger edit of Keith Haring's work also, because like, it's all about what you choose. And there's kind of two ways to go with it. Like, we've seen so many people do collabs with Warhol's estate, which is sort of similarly like ever present, has been licensed to death. And you either sort of go the like Comme des Garçons route, where it's like you pick the most obvious pieces, like the Marilyn, the Elizabeth Taylor, or you go the like Raf Simons when he was at Calvin Klein route, where you're picking like the most obscure Warhols imaginable. This was a little bit in the middle, but I feel like it could have used a more sort of authoritative edit of his work. And also like the takeout box, the rhinestone Chinese food takeout box. That makes me want to unalive myself.
Well, that is very damning, but I think the other issue, speaking to having a stronger edit, is all the other pieces outside of the Keith Haring stuff is all over the place. And frankly, looks like a lot of other things, right? There's a contingent in this collection of like kooky 80s grandma florals and ruffles that are very Alessandra McKelly. There's this sleek khaki bomber with black pants and a felt hat, which is very Michael Ryder for Celine.
There's also like one random pair of like Trompe l'oeil jeans, which is something that's been trendy for like the past 5 years now, like that Gaultier kind of look. Just strange to see that introduced with one piece for no reason, seemingly, at this particular time.
There was one piece that you and Lauren Kramer were talking about in our group chat that really made us all want to unalive ourselves, which is this orange romper that looks like a schoolgirl uniform with puffy sleeves and the green shoes. It just is bad. It's bad. It's ill-fitting. There's no Vuitton customer that wants that.
We should mention that Alana Haim was in the show.
That was a highlight.
That was cool. And, you know, she is one of the very few that can pull this stuff off. But I continue to be confused as to why this is still happening.
Especially because there has been a real musical chairs amongst the design houses and designers, Dario Vitale at Versace, where like we're just getting rid of designers after one season. And Nicola has been there. There was a CBS Sunday Morning piece in the run-up to this cruise show that I think said he's been there the last 13 years, 15 years. I mean, it is a long tenure. So it must be working.
He has done some good things. I don't want to be a bitch. I do think he's a genius, but I think, I don't know, he's like lost the plot or something at this point. He needs a new vibe. And maybe that could come if he wasn't working at Louis Vuitton.
But it's tough to leave because Dior, Louis Vuitton, Gucci, these are the crown jewels of the fashion houses where you get all of the resources.
Totally, but shouldn't Louis Vuitton think it's a problem that their menswear and their womenswear are like completely bifurcated? Like, shouldn't you have a sort of unified look?
Speaking of which, Pharrell would have done better with a Keith Haring collab.
Yeah, and a Keith Haring collab also feels just more true to Pharrell's interests and his pop art kid robot aesthetic. The boxing gloves, which I don't know if they were boxing gloves or handbags that looked like boxing gloves, that was very Pharrell. That was the influence of Virgil and Pharrell in this show.
For those who have not seen this particular look, because it's a real blink and you miss it. You only see it in the detail shots. It is the classic Louis Vuitton monogram canvas on a pair of boxing gloves thrown over a model's shoulders, which is why we can't tell, like, are they a piece of object art or are they a handbag?
I hope they're actually functional boxing gloves. I feel like that would be the coolest. But anyway, moving on.
Speaking of LVMH, they have long been looking to find a buyer for Marc Jacobs. Last year, we discussed a possible sale to the licensing company Authentic Brands Group, which ultimately fell through. But last week, the great Lauren Sherman of Puck News revealed that WHP Global, which owns Vera Wang, Rag & Bone, as well as G-Star and Express, had bought Marc Jacobs for $800 million. Which means for our boy, Marc Jacobs, who still owns 20% of the business, there are many Birkins, Gregory Crutzen photographs, and historical mid-century homes to purchase in his future.
Go off.
All right, so what does this mean? There is another element to this story, which is that G3 Apparel Group, who owns Donna Karan and Sonia Rykiel, have entered a 50-50 joint venture with WHP Global in acquiring Marc Jacobs. So G3 will acquire the Marc Jacobs operating business and enter into a long-term licensing agreement. According to Vogue, Marc Jacobs will stay on and he will continue in his role as founder, creative director, ensuring continuity of the brand's vision, runway collections, and fashion shows. So that makes me feel good that we're still getting Marc Jacobs fashion shows.
Although I feel like there is potential for some scary licensing deals.
Well, look, licensing gets a bad name because in the past it has driven brands like Halston and Gucci, pre-Tom Ford, into the ground, but licensing could be cool.
It could be, but have you seen what happened to Betsy Johnson?
There is that, but I feel like if Marc Jacobs is involved, if anyone understands the campy and potentially fun nature of licensing, it would be Marc Jacobs. And really, all I want back is Marc by Marc and like the specialty items.
The special item store.
Well, the special item store, but like the little knickknacks that we got from Marc Jacobs. I just want things other than that tote bag is what I'm trying to say.
I just want a t-shirt with naked Lil Kim telling me about skin cancer prevention. To be fair, they still do make those heart-shaped Marc Jacobs compacts and sell them at the bookmark store.
Which shouldn't be confused with the relaunch of Marc Jacobs Beauty, because it is Coty that owns the licensing for Marc Jacobs Beauty. And it was announced that they will be relaunching the Marc Jacobs Beauty line. They released the first round of products. And all I can say is that this makeup is for the anti-clean girl.
This makeup is for a very young consumer. And the packaging is drastically different than the last incarnation of Marc Jacobs Beauty.
But they understand what people want. And by people, I mean young girls and us, which is, I just want a cool looking compact that I can take out of my purse.
Totally. I love how maximalist it is. I love that they took a risk. I'm imagining that they are drawing inspiration from like Japanese and Korean makeup brands and how maximalist and crazy the packaging is. It's very Jeff Koons because it looks like there's little foil balloons on a lot of the products.
Yeah, I think those are the eyeshadows.
The eyeshadows are like star-shaped balloons, but then like the lipsticks, the mascara, they all have like little balloons stuck to the top.
Right.
The price is right. Everything is between $26 and $46.
It will be sold at Sephora.
And I'm into it. I like that they took a risk. It looks cute. It also feels like our beloved hard candy and Urban Decay products of the 90s were on the mood board, especially when it comes to the names of some of these products, which are very like cheeky and a lot of them have sexual innuendos.
Right, like joystick, blush stick.
Yeah.
Money shot highlighter gel.
That is straight out of the hard candy Urban Decay playbook.
The heart on lipsticks. And then if you've seen the Marc Jacobs Beauty ad, which is really incredible, they have the model saying Born Star over and over again, because that's what the eyeshadow is called. Get it, Chell?
I do get it. But I don't think it's actually going into Sephora stores, which sucks. I think it's online only.
Well, we must check our beloved Hollywood Boulevard Sephora, which is one of the most slept on Sephoras in Los Angeles, because who wants to go to Hollywood Boulevard? It's for tourists, but it is oddly stocked with almost every brand.
True, but you do have to go inside the scary prehistoric shopping center across from the Hollywood Roosevelt.
Which is also where they host the Oscars.
What else?
In a headline straight out of The Onion, except it is true, Shein, the fast fashion purveyor, bought eco-friendly clothing brand Everlane, which has left the entire industry scratching their heads.
Was Everlane ever that sustainable, though? Or did they just like tell you the upfront manufacturing costs of their products? Like that was their whole shtick.
Yes. So when Everlane began in 2011, it was more about price transparency. But as the years went on, there was more of a focus in sustainable practices. So it's not exactly shocking that Everlane was sold. Lauren Sherman, again of Puck News, reported that since March, they've been looking for a buyer to unload almost $90 million in debt that the company had accumulated. So it's not surprising that it was sold for $100 million. The shocking thing is that they sold it to Shein. Because when you think of all that is wrong with fast fashion, you think of that brand. And whether you were an Everlane customer, which I was at one point and then stopped, which is where Everlane got into trouble, right? As most elder millennials know, Everlane was once the shining example of what a millennial direct-to-consumer brand could be. They often touted, quote, radical transparency and were thought of as a newer Gap. But since the pandemic, they sort of lost their way with their consumer. Gap got better. Uniqlo got better.
Are any of these millennial brands doing well, is what I would like to know.
Well, here's the other element, is the founder of Everlane, Michael Pressman, left the company a few years ago. It was sold to private equity. So this sale is not because the founder sold it. It is the private equity company, L. Catterton, sold the company, their majority stake, to Sheehan. Now, what exactly is Sheehan going to do with Everlane? According to the current CEO, Alfred Chang, he said that Everlane will remain an independent brand and keep its sustainability commitments and frame the acquisition as a way to expand the brand's global reach and accelerate their vision, which sort of is in contrast to the idea of sustainability.
Well, yes, buying a company strictly for PR purposes does seem to run counter to that goal.
Well, just the idea that they're going to be accelerating their vision and global reach to me means they're going to just be expanding further and faster, which kind of goes against the idea of trying to be a sustainable brand. But really what they need to figure out is, what are they designing and who are they designing it for? Because I don't know if you've been to Everlane recently. It's rough.
No, I have not been to Everlane recently. I never shopped there.
I'm a basic bitch, so I shop there. I had their flats at one point.
It wasn't even that basic at a certain point to shop at Everlane, but something happened.
Uniqlo got good. They did collabs with really great designers. So that story happened. Who knows what will become of Everlane, but in a very Count of Monte Cristo twist, Everlane's founder, Michael Pressman, announced a few days ago that he will be launching Everlane again, but as a different company called Still Radical.
Terrible name.
Well, according to Vogue, because he left Everlane about a year ago, he has spent the last year working on an electrolyte brand called Drink Magna. And it seems like the purchase of his Golden Child company has made him stop, I guess, working on this electrolyte brand and pivoting back to creating Everlane 2.0. All that exists is you go to a website and it says same principles, but a new take. And this time, no venture capital, no private equity. Sign up is required. I'll email you. I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good on that.
Now, this Everlane story has allowed me to bring up an old news story that has been on my mind since I read it, and we haven't been able to discuss it, which is Allbirds. You remember that Obama-era DTC shoe company known for their sustainable wool and eucalyptus shoes? Well, they are now rebranding as an AI company. Yes, you heard that correctly, an AI company. So Allbirds sold their shoe IP and branding assets to American Exchange Group for $39 million. I assume this company will continue Allbirds as an actual shoe company. American Exchange Group is a licensing company who has other shoe brands like Aerosoles and Mud. But back to this Allbirds as an AI company. They will now be known as New Bird AI, and according to a recent press release, secured $50 million in financing to build out, quote, AI compute infrastructure with a long-term vision to become a fully integrated GPU as a service and AI native cloud solutions provider.
Okay, you're speaking in gibberish. Am I typing an AI prompt like on the sole of like an ugly sneaker, or are they discontinuing sneakers entirely and just starting an AI company?
That's what I'm saying. They sold all of their shoe IP to a licensing company.
Right.
And now they are rebranding as an AI company because Everlane and Allbirds have a shared origin in the sense that these were not fashion people who decided to disrupt the retail side of things by being direct to consumer. These are all Silicon Valley tech guys that decided to start fashion companies.
Right.
And it didn't make them as much money. Surprisingly, fashion doesn't have the infinite growth that tech does. And yes, they are fully pivoting to be an AI company.
Well, I guess, you know, the plus side being one less ugly shoe in the world.
I don't know. Who knows what this licensing company is going to do?
But also, who was buying those shoes? Was it like tacky elder millennials or was it boomers?
It's hard to say. It's just funny, and I mean, it's not funny, it's horribly sad and dystopian that a former fashion company is becoming an AI company, which, to answer your question about like what are they doing with this, in the press release they said the rise of AI development and adoption has created unprecedented structural demand for specialized high-performance compute that the market is struggling to meet. More word salad.
Sure, and like specialized to whom and for what?
I was shocked to learn that Allbirds, again, a fashion company making ugly sustainable shoes, raised over $200 million in private capital and peaked at a $4 billion valuation after it IPO'd in 2021. This is pre being an AI company.
Right. Wow.
Anyway, I feel like maybe our listeners missed this news story. It feels important.
It's really crazy.
You know what's also really crazy? The son of the Mango founder was arrested for his father's murder?
I can't wait to talk about this with you. This story has gripped me, truly.
Let the listeners know.
So the guy that started Mango is worth a shitload of money. Do you have that figure?
He was worth $4 billion at the time of his death.
So he has a son.
By the way, the father's name is Isaac Andek.
And the son, what's his name?
Jonathan.
The son, Jonathan, was in charge of Mango Man, apparently. I'm not super familiar with Mango Man. I asked Tat, like, is it good? Is it bad? She's like, it's really bad. The women's wear at Mango is pretty good, but the men's wear, terrible, worse than Zara.
I'm thinking about that because it's like, I think I've definitely gotten Paul a piece or two from Mango. Not in a few years, though.
I'm sure there's something good at Mango Man. But anyway, that was this man's job, was running Mango Man. And he went on a hiking trip with his dad. And according to him, when his back was turned, his dad fell off a cliff and plunged to his death. But basically, a year after this death, the son was arrested for the murder.
We should say, according to reports, his son was the only witness to his father falling off of a cliff.
I don't know if you've seen the Rachel McAdams film Send Help, Lauren, but there is a very similar scenario in that movie.
So it's interesting to note, you previously said that he was the head of Mango Men. 6 weeks after his father died, he was made vice president of the company. Since his arrest, he has stepped down as vice president. He said that these allegations were serious, unjust, and unfounded.
Although, according to The Guardian, the judge proceeding over this case believes that he played a quote-unquote active and premeditated role in his father's death. Apparently, some WhatsApp messages were uncovered, which expressed quote-unquote feelings of resentment, hatred, thoughts of death, and blaming his father for the situation.
Guys, we have to go back to calling people. I know WhatsApp is like, your messages are encrypted. No one can find them. Have you watched a true crime documentary? They can recover almost everything.
Also, like, maybe it's better to like not be super successful because then your child could be jealous and murder you.
This does feel like a possible succession storyline because this son is the eldest of the three children. I wonder how the other children feel.
Probably not good.
Well, does this mean that the second eldest is now the vice president of Mango?
Who's running Mango Man?
We should say Mango was started by two brothers, one that was pushed to his death allegedly by his son, and then the other brother who is alive and hopefully has a great relationship with his children. I'm sure he's rethinking that now.
It's just such a wild story.
We did a early Every Outfit episode called Fashion Crimes that I want to do again.
Yeah.
There's definitely been more fashion crimes since we first did this episode.
Oh, yeah. And there are a lot of older ones that we just never talked about. But this is a very compelling story for sure.
Yes. Here at the Every Outfit podcast, we will be monitoring the situation.
And also, guys, it looks like Mango Man could have a glow up on the horizon because on June 4th, they will release a collaboration with Eckhouse Lotta.
Ooh, now that's good.
So we'll all have a lookout for that. Okay, that sound means that we have someone to say sorry to.
Well, yes, I have to apologize to the fuckheads. I am sorry that I once again referred to the actor James Remar as Richard Remar during our Sex and the City rewatch episode, you can at least see how I did this. I conflated his character Richard Wright with his name James Remar, hence calling him Richard Remar, which frankly, I mean, it does flow off the tongue better.
Very catchy. Like Richard Ramirez. It's so funny because I have listened to edits of the podcast before where I have heard you say this multiple times. I always cut it out. I always forget to tell you to stop doing this. And I'm always like, how am I not noticing you saying this in the moment? That's the thing that drives me crazy. With last week's episode, though, I had to leave it in because there was simply like no way to cut it out.
And I'm fine with these mistakes. I do think it's interesting that you don't hear that I'm saying something wrong because, to let people in on the podcast, sometimes we each say something incorrectly and we will correct the other. We edit that out of the podcast. Somehow, just Richard Wright as Richard Remar.
We do this all the time, both of us. Like, it's truly like the Brittany Murphy Girl Interrupted Eden Chicken situation. And I just want to put this to the audience, like people that may have like medical backgrounds, like, what's wrong with us?
Well, I'm going to blame postpartum, quote, mommy brain. For you, I'm not sure.
You were like this before you had a kid, though.
Yeah, but I'm going to blame the kid for this.
You don't get to blame it. Like, we clearly have like some sort of like neurological issue or something.
Well, on that profound and sad note, I'm going to say goodbye.
Bye, guys. Hopefully for next week's episode, we could get our hands on some of that jalapeno infused Sauv Blanc.
Anyone at InVivo want to send us some, we will drink it on the podcast. We're very intrigued. Although, I don't know where you got June. I saw midsummer, which could mean anything.
I saw June somewhere. I swear to God.
All right, guys. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye.